Joining me today is Kyle Moore, who is pursuing a PhD in economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Kyle is also a research scholar at the Economic Democracy Initiative at Bard College and a research fellow at the Global Institute for Sustainable Prosperity. Hi, Kyle, and welcome to Radioactive.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Kyle is joining me today to discuss how we measure unemployment and why this data is important to understand. We're currently experiencing one of the largest scale employment experiments in economic history. At the beginning of the last year, the United States instructed U.S. workers to stay home to limit the spread of COVID-19. Many workers were able to transition to remote work, but many more were forced out of unemployment. In the first week of April 2020, first-time unemployment claims topped 6 million, and from April through August 2021 remained above a million each week. The previous high had been 660,000 in the last week of March 2009. During the pandemic, we saw the unemployment rate climb to 14.8%. For reference, the unemployment rate during the Great Recession peaked at 9.9%, and the Great Depression approached 25%. Since the depths of the recession, we have seen unemployment situation improve as conditions are allowing people to return to the workplace. The generally positive July jobs report stated that payrolls had increased by nearly a million jobs and unemployment rate was at 5.4%. Despite these positive numbers, some economists and policymakers warn that employment is still in a dire situation. These wary observers point to the participation rate, which has only increased to 61.47%, which is well below the pre-pandemic level of 63.5%. In this brief description alone, I've used many numbers that are convenient to rattle off in an argument, but each one measures a different aspect of employment. Today, it is especially important to understand the information presented in the media because we are living through an unprecedented effort to manage the economy through a pandemic. So without getting too far into the weeds of data collection, Kyle is here today to help me explain how we create these numbers and the different information we can learn from each. To give us some context on what we are experiencing today, Kyle, can you describe the general pattern of unemployment we see through the business cycle and how the current unemployment situation resembles or differs from the cyclical unemployment?
Yeah, definitely. So, right now with what's going on, it's certainly a unique situation, but it does underscore sort of a broader point that no two expansions, no two recessions are ever exactly identical. And so there are sort of general patterns that we usually see over the cycle that allow us to talk about something that we can refer to as the business cycle, but the specifics are never exactly the same. And there's always sort of longer trends at play, policy responses differ. The way we respond to a crisis sort of sets the stage for another one. But with that caveat, what we typically see is a very rapid and steep increase in unemployment at the onset of a crisis or recession. And then it generally takes much, much longer for unemployment to return to its pre-recession levels. And I think there's sort of two main points to take away from that. So first, when we say pre-recession level, that implies that there was actually unemployment before the recession as well, right? We've never effectively eliminated unemployment, at least not in the post-war era. We've always had many more people looking for jobs than jobs available. Second, though, that means that the employment growth that we usually see coming out of recessions is generally very sluggish, pretty slow. And as a result, the labor force participation rate, which you mentioned earlier, usually falls dramatically at the start of a recession. And one of the other things that we usually see is that the composition of the unemployed changes over the business cycle. Right? So almost by definition, the prevalence of long-term unemployment is going to increase the farther away we get from that initial spike in unemployment. We usually also see a rapidly growing gap between the number of workers that are looking for work, whether those are the officially unemployed or some that aren't counted in some of those measures, and the number of jobs available, right? That's a feature that we saw this time around. So how does the current situation that we're looking at, this pandemic recession, sort of stack up against these general patterns? We're seeing a lot of these again, but I think the biggest difference is that we seem to be going through all these different aspects of the typical cycle much, much faster. It almost feels like we're in sort of a sped up cycle in comparison to what we've experienced over the last couple upswings and recessions. Right, so what does that mean? So we did have the steep increase in unemployment this time. As you mentioned, it was almost overnight in spring of 2020. Right? We had so many unemployment claims being filed within a period of weeks that, you know, the websites for these in several states crashed because of how many people were applying. And that's unprecedented. The employment reached its low point that spring, and it's been climbing back ever since. In a normal recession, we don't really see that sort of suddenness of the increase in unemployment and the turnaround to when employment starts growing. So that is unique this time. Some of the similarities, though, that are a bit more worrying. So we do see a large share in the increase of long-term unemployment amongst the unemployed. Right now, it's about 40%. So that means a little under half of all unemployed workers have been unemployed for more than 6 months. Right? So for comparison, coming out of the 2008 financial crisis, that share was only slightly higher, about 45% in 2010 and 2011. So that's a very worrying trend that we're seeing, this increase in long-term unemployment. But it is, unfortunately, pretty similar with the pattern that we expect. We also saw that initial gap in job openings versus people looking for work, especially in the spring and summer of last year. It's closed since then. It's not nearly as big, but by any reasonable measure, there's definitely still more people wanting to work, looking for jobs, than there are job openings. We even, though, are getting to the labor shortage story. I'm sure listeners have heard this in the news. This was something that we also heard in 2018, 2019, at the tail end of that previous cycle. So again, just all of these dynamics in the span of about 18 months, it does feel like we've just condensed that cycle into a much shorter period of time.
So before we jump into how we understand these measures that you and I have both been referring to, can you speak a little bit about why knowing about the unemployment situation is important for understanding the state of the economy?
Yeah, definitely. So I think there's a few reasons why this is important. So maybe just to focus on two or three here. So first, it matters for policymakers, right? Policymakers are looking at these types of measures, trying to get a sense of what the state of the economy is at any given point, what the forecasts are, how they think the situation might change, to design their responses to it. So, you know, I don't think the types of policies that we've seen, the stimulus checks, the extension of unemployment insurance this time, you know, those policies wouldn't have come about if we didn't have a good sense of the unemployment situation. Now, in saying that, I also don't want to imply that policymakers are just sort of passively sitting there watching this and thinking of the best way to respond. It took all kinds of pressure from a lot of groups and, you know, a lot of activists to get these types of measures in place. So that's quite important as well. But these groups too are using, you know, these types of statistics and data to formulate their advocacy work. Second, though, I think what looking at the unemployment situation reveals is that it provides a pretty good sense of how our economy works. And that doesn't mean that things can never change or anything like that. But when you study the unemployment situation, you realize that it both persists and changes over the economic cycle, over the booms and busts, the business cycles that we've been talking about. And that in itself, I think, provides a pretty important insight into how this type of economy works. We see that unemployment really is a normal feature of our economy, and that while it fluctuates over time, it's never eliminated. And that means unemployment isn't really an imperfection or some kind of quirk of our economy. It's really fundamental. It's a part of it. And that, I think, has some pretty important implications for how we think about the causes and ways we might try and address unemployment. If there's always, you know, for example, more people looking for work than there are jobs available, like a game of musical chairs, right? The deck's always sort of stacked against the unemployed. And as long as that's the case at the economy-wide level, some people are going to be without jobs. It has nothing to do with laziness or poor work ethic or low skills or any of those types of things that we hear often, we're hearing now. It's a structural feature. So I think, you know, studying the unemployment situation helps kind of helps you see this, right? I think you're often led to this sort of conclusion. And then, you know, most importantly and really, really tragically, what we're talking about when we talk about the unemployment rate and the unemployment figures, the unemployment situation, is really the livelihoods of millions of people in this country. Right? And unemployment, even though we talk about it as an economic phenomenon, it's much broader. It is, you know, it's a social problem in every sense. There's all kinds of studies that show the harms that unemployment has for individuals, for their families, for the communities in which the unemployed live. Right? So obviously there's a loss of income that comes with unemployment. And for the vast majority of people, wages are their primary source of income. But once you sever that link, especially if there's, you know, little certainty about becoming reemployed and finding work in the future, you have limited unemployment benefits, you're throwing people into a crisis, right? And it's not just the unemployed themselves that suffer this, but their children, dependents, other family members, suffer the repercussions of all of this. Right now, as we're going through this pandemic and trying to socially distance, we've heard, you know, warnings from health experts about the toll that takes on mental health in general. And so you add employment on top of that, and it's really a genuine crisis. It's intergenerational as well, right? We've seen studies about the children of people who become unemployed starting to struggle in school as the income earners and their households face unemployment.
I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind that I want to stress right now as we have this conversation about, as we start to get more into how we create these numbers and discuss these things as numbers themselves. And you see them in the news, but this is real people's lives, and that we're talking about is people having lost income. And so these numbers are important to that. And I think that's an important point that you raise, Kyle, that it's much more than just an economic indicator. We're learning something about the state of people's lives when we hear these numbers. So going from there into moving more towards the raw data aspect of this and the numbers, one of the most common figures that we hear about is the unemployment rate. But in addition to this, there are a number of alternatives that we hear about, such as the participation rate. Do you mind running through a couple of these numbers that you think are important? How do we arrive at the numbers, and what does each mean?
These numbers and how they're created, I think, are definitely important because we hear them, you know, in the news, we read about them, we hear them discussed all the time, but they can be a little misleading if we don't go into how they're calculated. The reason, I mean, just to start in the broadest terms, why we have these different measures is that no single figure that we have really captures the full picture of what's going on. Right? So even though unemployment might seem to have a kind of common sense meaning, you know, sort of how we've been discussing it so far in this conversation, it's a tricky phenomenon to try and measure precisely. Right? And that's largely because the real world is always a lot more complicated than these kind of blunt measures. So I think one way to kind of think about the difficulty and see how it is created is to put yourself in the shoes of, you know, someone working at one of the government agencies whose job it is to calculate the unemployment rate. You know, think what you would do if you were asked to go count the number of unemployed people in your community or in your city, right? Who would you include? Who wouldn't you include? It's pretty clear that you probably wouldn't include the people that have jobs, but when you get to the rest of the population that isn't working, it becomes a lot murkier. It's a lot more blurry. So to just do kind of a stupid extreme example, you wouldn't count newborn babies probably as unemployed, even though they obviously don't have jobs. You probably wouldn't include seniors in nursing homes as unemployed, even though they also probably don't have jobs. So as you start thinking of other groups that aren't working, though, you have to sort of come up with some criteria to distinguish the unemployed from the rest of the population that isn't working. Right? Most countries use slightly different criteria in their unemployment statistics, right? And that doesn't mean that one is necessarily more correct than the other. It's an indication, I think, of how the measures differ in different societies, different countries, different economies, and that it is, you know, both an art and a science, I guess. There's a bit of subjectivity in it. So the way that the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, that's the organization that calculates the unemployment rate, the labor force participation rate, defines unemployment is somebody that's at least 16 years old. Right? So you have to legally be allowed to work. We don't generally employ 10-year-olds anymore, so we don't consider them unemployable. But so 16 years old, not employed, you need to want a job, so you need to want to work, and then you have to have actively sought work in the past 4 weeks.
I'm on you.
So the first three of those are pretty straightforward. It's the last one, the having actively sought work in the past 4 weeks, that is a bit more controversial. There isn't really much of an economic reason for using that criteria, right? Why 4 weeks versus 3 weeks or 5 weeks? Right? As long as there's too few jobs available for all those wanting to work, it doesn't really matter how long or short you make the search period. Some people are always going to be without. Right? So if you stop counting people as unemployed, if they stop looking for jobs that probably don't exist, you know, it's a bit of a problematic definition. But in any case, that's how we measure it. And so the unemployment rate is the number of officially unemployed people, those who meet those four criteria I just mentioned, divided by the number of unemployed and employed workers in the economy. The long-term unemployed are those that have been officially unemployed for more than 6 months. Right? So they've been constantly looking for work and haven't been able to find it. Right? But we know that there's millions of working-age people that are neither employed nor in the unemployment statistics, so the unemployment rate isn't really telling us anything about this population. This is where the labor force participation rate comes in. So the labor force participation rate, sometimes we just call it the participation rate, is meant to give a sense of how much of the population that could work is either employed or actively seeking employment. And so right now, as you mentioned, the participation rate is a little under 62%. So that means that about 62% of the population that could be working either already is or is actively looking for work, is officially unemployed. So for comparison, the labor force participation rate was about 63.5% in February of 2020, right on the eve of the pandemic. But one of the things that we've seen over a longer period in the U.S. economy is that the labor force participation rate has fallen pretty sharply after each of the past few recessions. Right? So the labor force participation rate fell after the 2008 financial crisis and never recovered. It fell again during the current crisis last year when the pandemic really hit, and hasn't recovered to its pre-pandemic level yet either. So we've seen a longer-term decline in the U.S. labor force participation rate that becomes worse, dramatically so, after each recession. And now why does that matter? Right? What do we see when we look at the unemployment rate and the labor force participation rate together? Okay, so the unemployment rate generally increases very quickly at the start of a recession, but also falls fairly quickly thereafter. The labor force participation rate doesn't really do that. It falls, and it very slowly, if at all, increases. Right? So what that means is that even though unemployment looks like it's falling, a lot of people are probably just giving up looking for work. They can't find jobs. If they stop looking for work, they're no longer included in the unemployment figures. They move out of the labor force altogether. That in itself brings down the unemployment rate. But so this is where it can be a little misleading. We might see the unemployment rate go down and think that means all of those unemployed people got jobs, but that doesn't follow from how the unemployment rate is constructed. So that's why we want to look at these two measures in conjunction with one another. Right? A healthier sign of recovery would probably be an increase in labor force participation rate rather than a falling unemployment rate in and of itself.
I think that's an important point you make at the end, is that these numbers need to be considered for what they actually mean, the definition, and how they relate to each other. To turn to another way that we measure unemployment, and in the beginning, I mentioned the trends we are seeing in first-time claims for jobless benefits and an increase in payrolls. These numbers reflect people transitioning into or out of unemployment. Some of your recent work has focused on transition rates. What are employment transitions, and how do they differ from an unemployment rate?
The main thing that unemployment transition rates, labor force transition rates are trying to capture is how these measures, how the unemployed, the employed, these other populations change over time. Whereas the unemployment rate, as we were just discussing, it's more of kind of a snapshot of one moment in time. It doesn't tell us much about how the economy is changing from one month to the next. And so every month we get an estimate of how many unemployed people there are in the country. Every month it's different. And so looking at transition rates helps us understand how those numbers are changing. And basically we can follow the individual people that are in the surveys that the government uses to calculate the unemployment rate over a series of months and see how their employment situation changes. Are they moving from unemployment in one month and they have a job the next? Are they unemployed again in the next month? Are they moving out of the labor force altogether? Right. Transition rates are looking at these over time, how these different populations are either growing or shrinking. Okay. The reason I think this is an important complement to some of the more snapshot measures like the unemployment rate or the participation rate is that it helps uncover how those measures are moving. And so we see the rate and the frequency at which people are leaving or gaining jobs, the characteristics of those groups, seeing who's moving in and out of employment, in and out of unemployment, which gives us a, I would say, kind of more insightful view of the unemployment situation than just a series of snapshots alone. So one of the things that we can see with the transition rates is differences in who's getting jobs, who's remaining unemployed, who's leaving the labor force altogether. And because we use the sort of detailed data set that the government agencies use, we can see a lot of the demographic characteristics of the workers that make up these transitions. So one of the things that we're seeing now, for example, is that unemployed white workers are still a bit more likely to transition into employment from one month to the next than they are to transition out of the labor force altogether. For black workers, on the other hand, this ratio is flipped. Black workers, what we're seeing is, or black unemployed workers, I should say, more likely to transition out of the labor force altogether than they are to transition into employment from one month to the next. And so this is reflecting a lot of existing inequalities in our economy, right? And it's showing the sort of hierarchies of who's getting jobs over this recovery. So when we look at the rate at which the unemployed are getting jobs or moving out of the labor force or remaining unemployed, we're seeing something quite different than what we can infer just from the unemployment rate itself. The unemployment rate can move for all sorts of different reasons, as we've discussed. And so we want to use transition rates, other measures to look at, you know, who's actually getting the jobs.
Great, thank you. And I think that definitely helps us at least look at these numbers, and when we hear them in the news and what we read, what we're actually hearing, what kind of information we're actually getting. And right now we're generally getting, I think, a positive look on the economy. And I think that a lot of, at least what's being said in the media that comes across my feed, is that the outlook is generally positive, with some headwinds coming up now as we're seeing an expansion or an increase in number of coronavirus cases, as well as some of the stimulus running out from the past year. So we generally positive outlook, but some headwinds coming. So over the next 3-4 months, what are some of the things that you will be looking for to understand how the economy is performing?
Yeah, so I think that's generally the case. Things seem to be better than they were, you know, in the spring of last year, but we definitely haven't recovered. So, you know, I'll be looking at a lot of these measures that we've talked about, but that's kind of been the main point of the conversation so far. So maybe it makes sense to think about some broader trends in the economy that could be some of those headwinds you mentioned. So first, I think you're absolutely right to mention the increase in infections. Right? This will have a tremendous impact on unemployment going forward, whether there's more shutdowns, whether you know, schools that are reopening now may switch to more remote learning. Right? Having children at home that need to be taken care of has a very important impact on especially female labor force participation, as a lot of those burdens are gendered. So we'll definitely be keeping an eye on that. Things like the eviction moratorium that was recently extended and, you know, might expire if there isn't further action is something else that I think, you know, is worth watching about, not just for the employment impact, but the human cost of that as well, right? Very, very difficult to try and maintain a job or secure one if you're housing insecure. Another thing too, at this point in time, what happens with unemployment insurance in September, right? There's a lot of extensions that are scheduled to expire then. There hasn't really been as much talk about that, it seems, in Congress or in the national media about those extended benefits running out. But if benefits are cut and there aren't jobs to return to, you know, that's a pretty devastating policy. Another thing to keep in mind, and this goes back to the infections, we don't necessarily want to force workers back or even create job opportunities in situations that are going to be very high risk and that have a high likelihood of spreading the virus. Right? But on the other hand, that doesn't mean that our alternatives are limited to mass unemployment or forcing people into unsafe working environments, even though arguably that's how a lot of the pandemic response has been going so far. There were policies we saw in a lot of other countries where payroll was effectively nationalized. Right? Workers kept their jobs, they kept the income, the government provided support for this, kept the businesses afloat. So it doesn't have to be a trade-off between mass unemployment or returning to unsafe conditions. And I think this is something that should be at the fore of the thinking about the response to the current crisis. Because I don't think we'll have a complete response until people feel comfortable and are comfortable going back into those types of environments. And so making sure the virus gets under control is central, I think.
Kyle, that's all the time we have for today. I appreciate you joining us, walking us through what can be a relatively complicated subject. So hopefully listeners have a better understanding of how we create our unemployment measures. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.